Ted, you have you got one more piece of skate business for us.
Perhaps it's just a question, a clarification. So on the committee meetings to look at breaking up the complex, when is that going to be discussed, under a different part of the meeting, or is that going to the PDT already for analysis?
The PDT, as Vincent just reported, those motions have tasked the PDT to do the analysis.
So we'll come back deal with that at the next committee meeting.
And that will come back to the next committee meeting.
I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Anything further? Well, thank you, Vincent and Fiona, and Matt and Laura, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am the vice chair. I'm standing in for Doug Grout today. As we all know, he can't be with us, and I think I can speak for all of us when I say that our thoughts are with him and his own in this hard week for him. The hearing committee materials can be found on behind tab 5 in your binders. The committee met on September 19, 2013 in Peabody. The advisory panel met the day before. Both groups discussed the Framework 3 alternatives to the 2014 and 15 catch cap options for river herring and shad. And the committee also discussed the partial improvement of Amendment 5, and along with issues related to the 2014 council management priorities. The AP meeting the day before was, discussion was tense, from what I understand. The chair is unable to be with us today, but the summary report is document 5 behind tab 5. The short version of it is that after earnest and energetic discussion, the AP recommended a no-action alternative for the river herring and shad catch cap. David Bethoni presented his work with the SMAST and DMF on the ongoing river herring bycatch avoidance program, which was well-received, strongly supported. And then Lori took us through the draft Framework 3 discussion document that she will be taking us through today, which produced a lively discussion. And ultimately, the committee produced two motions, one regarding the Framework 3 issues that we'll get into in more detail in a moment, and the other one regarding management priorities for 2014. What I'd like to do this morning, given these items, is I would like to ask Lori, if it's okay with her, if she could take us through the list of the disapproved elements of Amendment 5 so everybody is clear as to what is on the table for that, and then go into more detail with the Framework 3 river herring and shad bycatch cap options that the committee discussed last week. If that's okay, I'll turn it over to you.
Lori.
Thank you. Before I go into the presentation, as Matt indicated, I'll just very briefly summarize the issues related to the partial approval of Amendment 5. I think a lot of these issues will be revisited later today in subsequent discussions under other agenda items. There is a letter that was distributed for this meeting from the regional office regarding the partial approval of Amendment 5 and some potential steps that the council may want to consider to revise or reconsider the measures that were disapproved. The letter is dated September 20th, and I will just ask the regional office staff to please feel free to chime in if I skip over anything crucial. The three major elements of Amendment 5 that were not approved, as most of you are aware, are the requirements for 100% observer coverage on Category A and B herring vessels that was to be phased in over the first year with an industry-funded monitoring program that sought a target maximum contribution of $325 a day from the industry. That element of the amendment was not approved. In the letter to the council, the regional office made some suggestions on how to potentially address that issue. I'm going to just not get into that too much right now because we have an agenda item this afternoon about industry-funded observer coverage. But the letter does suggest that the council may want to consider an omnibus, working with NIMS on an omnibus regional amendment to address cost sharing or to establish a cost sharing mechanism across all of our FMPs. And as part of that, to consider Category A and B herring coverage. So that was the suggestion from the regional office that I think we'll talk about later this afternoon. The second element of Amendment 5 that was disapproved are the trip termination, the slippage caps, the area and gear-specific slippage caps and trip termination provisions. Amendment 5, the measures in Amendment 5 to require full sampling and to prohibit slippage under, except for under certain circumstances, those measures were approved, but the part that was disapproved were the caps. We had proposed slippage caps by gear type and area where once the cap is reached, any further slippage events would require trip termination. The regional office in their letter dated September 20th has suggested that we may want to consider revising those measures to be more reflective of the closed area one sampling requirements, which in the event of a slippage, the vessel would be required to leave the area or be required to leave either a management area, a statistical area, something like that. So that was one of the suggestions that was made to potentially revise that measure. And then the last element of Amendment 5 that was disapproved were the requirements, the dealer reporting requirements, the requirements for dealers to weigh all fish. The measure was somewhat vague, so the suggestions from the regional office include clearly defining what that means and laying out what would represent accurately weighing the fish. And the regional office also suggested that we could revisit one of the options in Amendment 5, which would require vessel owners to review data regarding their sale to dealers on through the Fish Online, review and confirm the dealer data through Fish Online to to minimize some of the reporting errors and discrepancies in the data. So these are all in the letter in terms of suggested ways that we could potentially revisit the Amendment 5 issues. What remains unclear, and again, I think we'll get back to this afternoon, is how to do that. It wasn't clear at the committee meeting whether or not there is really an amendment revision process, or if we were just talking about entering into a new action, whether it be an amendment or a framework adjustment, depending on what the issue is and how we want to address it. That's kind of where we were at the committee meeting. We were unclear on what the process may be, but I think some of that will come to light this afternoon during the discussion of both industry-funded monitoring and management priorities. With that, I'll turn to Matt if you want to add anything else before I get into the Framework 3 issues.
No, I think we should, if people want to move along right into Framework 3, then we can go from there.
Okay.
Tom.
Well, I just wanted to follow up, and maybe we should consider before we jump into the framework, the point that Lori just made, which is the first decision of the day, which is how we're going to respond to the parts of Amendment 5 that were disapproved, and what action or what vehicle there is to do that. I don't think we want to – I certainly don't want to push all that to an omnibus amendment or cost-sharing industry coverage amendment discussion this afternoon. I think we should deal with Amendment 5 during, you know, within the FMP discussion. So before we jump into the framework, I'd state my preference that I think we should handle the Amendment 5 revisions and issues as quickly as possible in a herring-specific and focused way, And I think we should make whatever revisions we can today and do it in a meeting cycle or two. I don't want to push this till what I think will be a very broad, expansive, multi-FMP process of industry-funded observer coverage. And if we are going to take that step and we are going to present revisions, I'm prepared to bring motions to do that today.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We certainly did discuss this issue at the committee. And as Lori indicated, the actual process for doing what you suggest was unclear. And so I think we first need to have clarification on what that process would be. Some of the correspondence from the agency was referencing, you know, sending the amendment back for council revision. They were seeking advice from other regions that may have already have done this in some instance so that it could be clear on what that process was. And it sounded like that they were still doing that. And even if we were to revise it, it sounded to me as if it still would be, could take a little bit of time, that it would, you know, perhaps, you know, public hearing process and not just simply making some changes and sending it back. Anyway, it didn't sound like that. It sounded like there would be more to it than that. But again, as Lori indicated, it still was not quite clear. So first, I think we have to figure out what the process is. And part of that decision making would be to listen to the whole discussion, which is next on our agenda, about industry-funded programs and what we would need to do and should we address it FMP-specific or an omnibus. So I appreciate the enthusiasm on the other side of the table with motions, but I don't think we're really quite there. I think first we have to define, you know, the process for moving forward and make some decisions about, you know, what our priorities are. There is a committee motion relative to this that I'm sure that Matt will bring up that signals an intent to move forward. And I would think that kind of holding off at the moment might be a better path.
Before we roll our sleeves up and try to fix something on the fly, get some counsel from Mitch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So one of the reasons why the guidance has been a little unclear is that because it's an unusual circumstance, and typically what's been done to date is that it's handled in an amendment process. The resubmission, the revision is handled in an amendment process. If there were going to be an opportunity to do something in a framework, that would really depend on the specific measures that you would decide to take up. So in almost classic lawyerly fashion, the answer is it depends, right? It depends on what you choose to do and how you choose to do it. For example, if you were to do all three measures together, that would be another, that would be an amendment process. Of course, the analysis, some of the analyses you've done in Amendment 5 already will support your efforts in some of those measures. To the extent that you divvy up the measures and, for example, handle the catch cap as a singular measure, it's possible that that could be done by a framework, in a framework style action. So some of this, it depends on how you want to, it depends on how you want to handle it. Typically, it's been done as an amendment process. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I can speak as a council member, not as acting chairman, I think there's two issues in stake here. There's a structural problem with this question about how do we do industry-funded monitoring, and we'll get more information about that this afternoon. And that is going to be a longer-term problem. It's going to take some work, and we're going to have to, you know, roll up our sleeves and hammer on that. But I think there's some short-term needs for something in this FMP that we need to address much quicker than an omnibus amendment or a more protracted development process. And so I think I'd like to hear what Tom has to propose, again, speaking as a council member, because I think we've got two time frames here, and one's short-term and one's a long-term.
Council discussion? Tom?
Well, I agree with Matt. I think we are talking about two time frames here. And as much as we tend to deal with many of our problems in a very bureaucratic, slow-moving way, that at times is absolutely appropriate, and at times it absolutely isn't. So Hearing what Mary Beth said and understanding that the committee's done some work here, I'm happy to see the committee's discussion, and we'll come back to making that decision about what the process is and what we can do, how we want to move forward to address those midterm issues, both for the herring fishery and other fisheries, and then what we want to do in the short term to address, I think, a more urgent issue. So I'm happy to have this discussion after Lori's presentation.
I mean, my sense is the committee did work. There's a committee motion specifically to address a task from the council to develop a catch cap. I think we should hear Lori's presentation, make action on the framework, and then move on from there. So, Lori, let's please continue.
Okay. Everybody should have a copy of the draft framework 3 document. It's the larger document in your binder. And I believe my presentation slides were distributed this morning. I'll try to move quickly and not ramble too much. The Framework 3 timeline, just to refresh your memory, we did vote to initiate this framework in January as soon as we finished final decisions on the specs and Framework 2. So we had the initial council meeting for this framework in June. Prior to that June meeting, the committee and the advisors had met. The PDT and the Squid Mackerel Butterfish Monitoring Committee met jointly. In June, the Mid-Atlantic Council did select their river herring and shad catch cap for the mackerel fishery for 2014. So we had our initial framework meeting. Since that time, the advisors, PDT, and committee have all met to complete the work on the framework so far. And this is the final framework meeting. So if we select final measures today, we will wrap up this framework and have it implemented sometime during the 2014 fishing year. The goals and objectives for Framework 3 were approved by the council at the June council meeting. The goal of Framework 3 is to establish a process for setting river herring and shad catch caps in the Atlantic herring fishery to achieve the following objectives. One, to provide a strong incentive for the industry to continue to avoid river herring and shad and reduce river herring and shad catch to the extent practicable. Two, enhance coordination with the Mid-Atlantic Council to address the overlapping herring and mackerel fisheries. Three, to promote flexibility to adjust the cap in the future as more information becomes available. Just as background, as I mentioned, the Mid-Atlantic Council did select a catch cap for 2014 for the mackerel fishery. The provisions for the cap were established in Amendment 14, which was the mackerel amendment that mirrored our herring amendment 5. The recommendation for the 2014 cap is 236 metric tons. This was based on an expanded catch estimate, the median value from, I believe, 2005 to 2012. The cap will apply to all trips landing more than 20,000 pounds of mackerel in all areas. When 95% of the cap is projected to be reached, all vessels will be limited to 20,000 pounds of mackerel. So the MID set a cap for 2014. Framework 3 will be including specifications for a cap for 2014 and 2015. The Mid-Atlantic Council will revisit their cap next year and make a recommendation for 2015. And then hopefully, I think the idea is for both councils to work together to try to coordinate the caps for 2016 and beyond. So in terms of Framework 3 and the decisions being made today, there's essentially two elements of Framework 3. The first one is the process and all of the provisions related to setting river herring and shad catch caps. This includes identification of the species that would be subject to the caps, the trips, that would be subject to the caps, the areas that the caps will be distributed to, reporting requirements, triggers for closing areas, all of that is procedural stuff. And that's all established in Framework 3 with the decisions made today, and that will all remain in place until further modified in the future by the council. Those are not things that we have to re-specify every time we set the catch cap. The second part are the catch cap specifications and the actual numbers. So in Framework 3, we are specifying caps for 2014 and 15. And then future catch caps would be set during the fishery specification process. Or other action, but the idea is to when we do the 2016 to 18 herring specifications, we would specify the river herring and shad catch caps for 2016 to 18 as part of that process. So just to run through the elements of the alternative two is the alternative that would establish the catch cap process and provisions. This is all based on what we talked about at the June council meeting and the guidance that we got from the council. Right now, the caps would apply collectively to four species of river herring and shad, two species of river herring, two species of shad. The catch of each of the species will continue to be monitored individually, but in terms of counting against a cap, all four of these species would count against the cap. The cap would apply on any trips landing more than 6,600 pounds of Atlantic herring. That's the cutoff for the open access permit. Caps will be distributed by area based on the statistical area clusters identified in Amendment 5. And when a cap is reached in an area or when the trigger is hit, the directed herring fishery will close in that area, and all herring vessels will be limited to a 2,000-pound trip limit in that cap area. So this figure here identifies the cap areas for you. There's four areas proposed. Again, these are based on the Amendment 5 river herring hotspot analysis. The Gulf of Maine area is all of these statistical areas in the Gulf of Maine, obviously only the ones in U.S. waters. I will be cleaning up this figure later. The Cape Cod area is statistical area 521. The Georges Bank area is the shaded area here in Georges Bank, all of the statistical areas offshore other than 521. And then the Southern New England Mid-Atlantic area is all of the statistical areas that are in Area 2. The Southern New England Mid-Atlantic cap area is the only one that is the same as one of our herring management areas. So Southern New England Mid-Atlantic cap area is equivalent to Area 2. Everything else is a little bit different because we've separated out the Cape Cod area. In terms of the provisions, no changes to trip notification requirements are needed right now. There is a proposed change to VMS reporting requirements in the document, and this is to try to streamline reporting and monitoring of all of the catch caps. We have the haddock catch cap that herring vessels are also subject to. If you look on page 16, the Framework 3 document explains that we are proposing to change daily VMS reporting to statistical area-based reporting instead of, I think right now, vessels have to report by haddock stock area in order to monitor the haddock catch cap. Because the haddock areas are different than the river herring areas, and they're different than the herring management areas, we're just proposing to require reporting by statistical area so that information can be fed to the regional office and they can use it for monitoring all the catch caps. The method for monitoring the caps, we've already heard a little bit of discussion about that this morning. The details are still to be determined and will be communicated to everyone by the regional office upon implementation or during the implementation of Framework 3. It will be similar, we assume, to monitoring methods for current catch caps. However, there's a little bit different, difference here because we are looking at total catch of river herring, including kept catch and discards. So the ratio that's utilized for monitoring the cap is going to be a little bit different. But we are anticipating those details to be provided by the regional office. Excuse me. There are two options under consideration for triggering the closure of a cap area. The first option is that the area would close when 100% of the cap is reached. That is consistent with the haddock catch cap. The second option is that the area would close when 95% of the cap is projected to be reached, and that is consistent with the Mid-Atlantic Council's river herring and shad catch cap. The herring committee is recommending option two, which is the 95% projection. In terms of future modification, again, just to reflect back on the objectives of this framework, two of the objectives are to provide flexibility and to enhance coordination with the Mid-Atlantic Council. So you will see that there is language in the alternative that would allow a future joint cap in the Southern New England Mid-Atlantic area to be implemented through the herring specifications process. We're trying to foresee how things may play out in the future so that we don't get ourselves in a situation where we need to do another framework adjustment to allow that to happen. So this framework will include that language, and it will be considered in the analysis in the document. This is actually a recommendation from both the Herring PDT and the Squid Mackerel Butterfish Monitoring Committee. And the committee has discussed it as well. Not to say that this is the way it's going to go, but we at least want to leave ourselves the option of being able to do this in a future specifications package. Okay, so the options, that's all the procedural stuff. The second element of this are the actual numbers for 2014 and 15. Appendix 2, you guys should all have three appendices. Appendix 1 is all of the background data, very detailed. Appendix 2 is the PDT's methods for developing the catch cap options. What you'll see in Appendix 2, what the PDT did is we took all trips from 2008 to 2012 that landed more than 6,600 pounds of herring, and we pulled all the observer records for those trips. We then added in all of the port site sampling records that we had for additional trips so that we had additional sampling to include when we developed the catch ratio. So we combined sea sampling and port site sampling, and we calculated a river herring and shad catch ratio for all trips that had either an observer or a port site sampler. And then we were able to, very similar to how the butterfish catch cap methodology works, we were able to expand that ratio out based on total landings to get a catch estimate for the fishery. And then we scaled it to the 2013 to 15 herring quota because we're basing this on 2008 to 2012 data, and we just increased the quotas for 2013 to 15. So we accounted for the fact that the quotas have increased, and we scaled up all the catch caps. This slide here just gives you an idea of the levels of coverage and sampling that we're dealing with. You know, data variability is a significant concern in this fishery, and particularly with river herring and shad. So, you know, we have, in some cases, very large CVs around our catch estimates. But once we added in the port side sampling data, we actually had pretty good coverage, and we were able to bring those CVs down. They're not fantastic, but they're a lot better. And if you look at some of the coverage levels here, you'll see in general for the Gulf of Maine, for all the gear types, we had 20% coverage or sampling, 58% in Cape Cod, 57% on George's Bank, and 24% in Southern New England Mid-Atlantic. So that's not bad. So what you get out of that is something that looks like this, which none of you can see. It is in Appendix 2, but this is just a figure that shows you what the catch estimates are by year, by gear type, and what the 95% confidence intervals are around those estimates. The numbers that are at the top of the bars are the number of trips that went into that estimate. So, you know, you can see in some cases we have pretty wide confidence intervals. In other cases, we're not doing too bad. So just to briefly go through the options, these are all in the document. In the Gulf of Maine area for 2014 and 15, and this is based on the information we have, the options would be to set no cap, to set one cap for all gear types, or to set individual gear-specific caps for any or all of the gear types in the Gulf of Maine. We, the PDT, provided options that were based on, from that distribution 2008 to 2012, the low value, the high value, the median value, and the weighted mean. Rather than just take the average of the 5 years, we weighted each of the years based on how much sampling occurred in that year, because we have a lot better sampling in 2011 and 12. So we weighted those years heavier in the weighted mean. The committee went with the 75th percentile. Out of all of those options up there for the Gulf of Maine, the committee recommended a midwater trawl gear-specific cap in the Gulf of Maine based on the 75th percentile, and that number is 91 metric tons. In the Cape Cod area, the only gear type that we've seen fishing or landing herring from that area is midwater trawl. So the options were to set no cap, to set one cap for all gear types fishing in the area, or to set a midwater trawl specific cap for Cape Cod. The committee again recommended a midwater trawl specific cap, 75th percentile, and that number is 39.6 metric tons. Southern New England Mid-Atlantic, the options are no cap for 2014-15, one cap for all gear types, or gear-specific caps for bottom trawl and or midwater trawl in the area. The committee recommended 75th percentile, gear-specific caps for bottom trawl and midwater trawl. The midwater trawl cap would be 277.2, and the bottom trawl cap would be 102.1. Another recommendation the committee made in Southern New England and Mid-Atlantic is that the cap closure area be the shaded area that you see on the figure here, and that when the cap is reached in Southern New England and Mid-Atlantic, in the Southern New England Mid-Atlantic area, only the shaded statistical areas in Area 2 would close. The offshore unshaded areas out here would remain open. This figure came from the Herring PDT's initial Amendment 5 hotspot analysis. This was our starting point for the River Herring Shad catch cap areas. What the PDT did was just to simplify things. We had proposed all of Area 2 be the Southern New England Mid-Atlantic cap area. What the committee's recommending is that all trips in this entire area count against the cap, but when the cap is reached, just the shaded blocks would close. Excuse me. And I think the intent here is to potentially leave these offshore areas open to minimize the impacts on the mackerel fishery. In Georges Bank, on Georges Bank, in the Georges Bank area, the options for 2014 and 15 are no cap, one cap for all gear types, or one cap for midwater trawl gear only. As you can see, the numbers are extremely low. We had almost 60% sampling and coverage on Georges Bank, and all of the coverage that we have is showing little to no river herring interaction in the Georges Bank area. The PDT recommends that we do not set a cap in this area for 14 and 15, and the Herring Committee supports that recommendation. So the committee is recommending no cap in Georges Bank for 14 and 15. We considered some comments from the regional office that were provided to us from the committee, at the committee meeting, and I just highlight these again so that everybody is aware. The regional office comments recommended setting one cap for each of the areas. The comments had suggested one cap for all gears in Gulf of Maine, Cape Cod, and southern New England. And this is primarily based on concerns about resources and the monitoring burden that may be associated with multiple caps in the area. It was clarified that the recommendation is one cap in each of the areas. It doesn't necessarily need to be one cap for all gear types. It could be just a midwater trawl cap or just a bottom trawl cap. But the recommendation based on the regional office's concerns about their resources and the monitoring burden is that we set one cap for each of those three areas. And they also support the recommendation for no cap in the Georges Bank area for 2014 and 15. The regional office reiterated their concerns about the burdens of monitoring multiple caps. This is a weekly monitoring based on daily VMS reporting, and with the way this fishery operates, there's a lot of concerns on their end about being able to monitor the caps on a real-time basis. Excuse me. Framework 3 impacts are discussed in the document, and I also provided a more detailed draft appendix that lays out some of the PDT's projections and simulations to look at what the effect of the catch caps may be and when the caps may trigger a closure of the fishery in that area and how that may affect the fishery's ability to achieve OI or fully utilize the ACLs. I won't go into a lot of detail here. I mean, in the Gulf of Maine, what the projections show is that under the low option, you're likely to impact the fishery. Obviously, under the low option, you're likely to reduce river herring and shad catch, but this option will likely also reduce herring catch and impact the fishery. The other options are not likely to do that. On Cape Cod, there's a lot more variability. The projections show that under both the median and low options, you could impact the fishery. In southern New England and the mid-Atlantic, again, same thing as Cape Cod. The projections show that under the median and low options, you could have an impact on the fishery. The concern in southern New England and mid-Atlantic is if you hit the cap early in the year, you may preclude herring fishing in the late part of the year because the fishery will already be closed, and that could definitely reduce catches in the area too. So, last slide is just a summary of the Herring Committee recommendations. The Herring Committee made one motion to include all of these recommendations. The recommendation is to adopt Alternative 2, which is the action alternative to set up this process and implement the provisions, to select Trigger Option 2, which is the 95% projection, to modify the VMS reporting requirements, and to modify the southern New England mid-Atlantic closure area based on the previous slide I showed you. And then this table just gives you the committee's recommendations for the amounts of the caps for 2014 and 15. That's all I have, and I'm happy to take questions.
That's all? Questions from the council. Mary Beth? We'll go right around the table.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Lori, for the presentation. I thought it was clear. The one question I had is that you mentioned of the CVs and they've improved with the added data. But I meant to ask this question before. There's a certain amount of error associated with basket sampling in a large, you know, volume fishery. Does that play into these CVs, or are these CVs just specific to, you know, levels of coverage and extrapolation of the, you know, observer data or shoreside data to total landings?
The CVs that I presented were just specific to the exercise that the PDT did and the extrapolation of the observed or sampled data to the total fleet. I think everybody recognizes that there's variability within the estimates because of the subsampling, but that isn't reflected in the CVs that I provided.
Well, thank you for that. That is what I understood, so I think it's important for everybody to realize that when you're doing 10 basket samples on a haulback of 200,000 pounds or more, there's a lot of error associated with that as well that's not incorporated. So these are pretty conservative, you know, compared to the cumulative error.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Lori, a question about your presentation on page 11. I don't see a number for the slide, but it's the Framework 3 impacts, Cape Cod and Southern New England, Mid-Atlantic. You have in that slide, in the reference to Cape Cod, an important point, and I don't understand that point. It says, under the median and low options, there is less variability because the directed herring fishery is likely to reach the river herring shad catch cap. And then you say, this could lead to lower catches in areas 1A, 1B, and 3 for 2014 and 15. I don't understand why the median would lead to lower catches in 1A, 1B, and 3. It seems to be inconsistent with the previous slide where you show, again, Framework 3 impacts. And you note that Gulf of Maine, low option may trigger a closure. I assume that means the median would not. But in the other slide, it indicates it might. So there's an inconsistency here. Could you explain what exactly is being provided to us as to the nature, possible impacts of these caps?
Sure. It's a little bit difficult to predict because the cap areas are not consistent with the herring management areas. So as we model herring effort, it's hard to predict, you know, if the cap area closes, how is that going to affect catch in the management areas. But that's essentially what we tried to do here. So if you go, and I think if you, you know, look at Appendix 3, hopefully it's a little more clear, but what we tried to do is we tried to model catch. We modeled catch to the point at which the trigger was reached and the cap area closed, and then redistributed fishing effort into the remainder of the open herring management areas to try to predict whether or not the closure of the cap area would affect the fleet's ability to catch the sub-ACL in the related management areas. What we found in the Gulf of Maine is that that's only going to happen under the low option. If you hit the cap under the low option and you close the Gulf of Maine cap area, you're going to have an effect on the Area 1A fishery because that whole area is going to be closed. In Cape Cod, the reason that in Cape Cod what you see is under the median and low options, you're going to hit the cap, and that could affect, the reason it says this could lead to lower catches in 1A, 1B, and 3 is because the Cape Cod area includes parts of all three of those management areas in it. So hitting the cap under either the median or low options on Cape Cod is potentially could lead to lower catches in 1A, 1B, and 3 because parts of those areas are going to be closed. And in some of the models, the fleet, you know, I mean, it depends. With modeling and 1,000 draws, you know, the fleet behavior, some of the effort is distributed elsewhere and some of it isn't. But under those two potentials, under those two scenarios, there was potential for the ACLs in 1A, 1B, and 3 to not be fully utilized. I hope that helps.
Mike?
This particular figure indicates that the total of the caps is the order of 400 tons, something like that. What are the implications of that in terms of the of the stocks that are being impacted, the river herring and shad. I mean, that to me is the bottom line as to whether this makes sense or not. Thank you.
No idea. The only thing that I can tell you, I mean, you can look at the data and see what how these numbers relate to other levels of river herring and shad catch that the herring fishery has taken. We have no idea how that impacts the stocks. We can't tie these caps biologically to the river herring and shad complex. All we can do is look at recent average catch and whether or not this would reduce or not.
John.
Lori, I thank you for a really complete presentation. It's an awful lot of information, and it ties to so many other issues. It ties to a previous issue that we spent time with on Amendment 5, and it ties to a future issue that we're going to wrestle with as to whether or not these should be stocks in the fishery. And it ties to an issue that the MID had a spirited discussion on that Chairman Robbins referenced, where they set a number at 236. And part of that discussion was, I believe one of the goals was to reduce the catch of river herring. And that was one of the reasons they ended up with a number of 236. And it's a data poor stock, which is why you can't answer Mike's very pertinent question. My question is the committee recommends 75th percentile, and my packet doesn't have page 2, which has the goals and objectives, so I can't remember when you got to that whether reducing catch of river herring is a goal or not. But I know when we get to the issue of whether or not river herring and shad should be stocks in the fishery, one of the things we're going to be looking at is are there other measures that provide adequate protection for river herring and shad and that already exist? And one of the questions we'll look at is, well, are there existing caps that provide protection for river herring and shad because they already provide protection, i.e. they already reduce catches? And so if we're setting caps that don't reduce catch, then we'd say, we'd check off the box, well, no, that doesn't provide protection because it doesn't reduce catch. So I think as we think about this discussion, as council members, we ought to be thinking a little ahead to a debate we're going to have somewhere in the future about should these be stocks in the fishery, and is this providing protection for river herring by reducing catch, or is it not? Is whatever that total number that Mike was referring to, is it reducing catch? Is that a goal, and is it meeting that goal? Does a 75th percentile achieve that? That was the spirited discussion that occurred at the MID, and 75th percentile seems pretty high to me to be doing that. But I'm sure this was discussed at the committee meeting, and so that's why I'm asking that question.
Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to respond to your question, Mr. Bullard, the committee discussed this at length. The 75th percentile actually was a product of a negotiation. There was a range of opinions about what it should be. We haggled over this, and while the motion to recommend the 75th percentile ultimately won, it was arrived at very, very, I won't say combatively, but we talked about this a lot. So it wasn't, there was much discussion. And so this was not something that we just glibly latched onto. We worked on this one.
PK?
Yeah, to that point, I think we started at the median and then we went up to the 75 percentile, also recognizing that the stock is going to be increasing in the years as well. So
we started on the high.
We started on the high.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, then we went down. Then we went back. Then we went, sorry. We thought the high was too high. We went to the median with the 75 percentile, recognizing that the stock will be increasing, and we're going to run into, I think Mark Gibson brought that up, that we're going to be encountering them even more. So the median was just seemed to be a little bit too low to possibly hit a trigger and shut down the industry.
Lori?
Yeah, just to add to that, I was going to make the same point. The committee did go round and round, and the goals and objectives clearly state that what we want to do is we want to provide an incentive for the industry to continue to reduce their catch. That's the objective that this council focused on. We ended up at a 75th percentile, as PK said, because there was recognition that the stocks are increasing in a lot of cases, and also in recognition of the significant concern about the cap monitoring and how this cap is going to be monitored on a week-to-week basis and the potential implications of closing down the fishery due to timing and data issues. So those are kinds of some of the concerns that we have to think about in terms of specifying the amount. And I will just note that the 75th percentile is still a reduction from recent years. I mean, we're looking at the last 5 years of catch data. And just, you know, for example, in the Gulf of Maine, the high year was 182.7. So what we're proposing in the Gulf of Maine is a 91-ton catch cap, which if you want to put perspective on this, based on the last 5 years, we're proposing something that would reduce from the high that we've seen over the last 5 years. And that is the case in all of the areas. We're proposing a value that's lower than the high catch value that was observed or calculated for the last 5 years.
Matt, then Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've said a couple times already that we believe the river herring and shad stocks to be increasing, yet this is a data poor stock. So I think we need to be careful about doing it. There are good indications, but I don't think we've got clear understanding yet as to what the biomass is. And if I'm mistaken with that, please someone correct me. The other issue is that, you know, given the variability in the data that Mary Beth mentioned, that going with a high value doesn't seem to be the most defensible one. Again, speaking as a council member now, I think the median is the most a median value represents a more consistent, more defensible, more predictive value to go with, and we can talk about that later. But
we're transitioning into discussion. I want to make sure everyone's questions are answered first. Tom and Terry.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I guess I had two questions as I look on this, and I'm looking now at the 2014-15 NERO comments, that slide. I don't have a number. It's on page 10. That highlighted bullet for no cap in the Georges Bank area, I understand that, but is it the intent to make, I mean, would that be frameworkable, and could we hardwire in this framework situations or circumstances or information that would trigger setting a catch cap for that area? It just seems like we wouldn't want to start at zero if and when we decide to set a cap for that area.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even if you recommend no cap, the only thing you're doing here is not setting a cap for 2014 and 15. The framework provisions establish the Georges Bank area and all of the related provisions. So this will be revisited for 2016, and the option will be available to specify a cap if necessary. All of the provisions for Georges Bank would be set up in this framework.
Great. Just a follow-up, it may be worthwhile, like we do with the scallop rotational access areas, to set sort of forward-looking triggers that say, if we see this, then this will spark at least consideration of some action in a following framework. I think that would be helpful. And then my second question is, it seems, and maybe I'm missing something, but it seems like we have only area-based catch caps and not an overall sort of backstop cap. And that seems like a departure from how we handle sea herring. We have in the Atlantic sea herring plan, we have a sort of sub-ACL for each area, quota associated with each area, and then a backstop overall quota. Why wasn't that sort of analogous pathway taken, and could it be now? It seems like it would be helpful, at least to me in thinking about it, that we would have one overall backstop cap and just knock some guy over.
We did not consider a fishery-wide cap. I don't think it's off the table. That I think that's something that could be considered. This fishery, the reason that we didn't is because we recognized the different components of this fishery and the fact that some of it occurs in the Gulf of Maine in the summertime and some of it occurs down south in the wintertime. And so I think there was a lot of concern about setting a fishery-wide cap. We considered, you know, as you can see in the options for each of the areas, caps for all gears combined, so sort of a fishery-wide within area cap. There was not really, beyond initial discussions, not a lot of talk about doing a fishery-wide cap because of the different elements of this fishery and the need to sort of treat them separately. But I think we could probably consider it if the council wants.
Terry.
So maybe I'm missing something here, but each one of these caps would close the area to all gear capable of catching river herring if they close. So like the Persing fishery in the Gulf of Maine would be closed down. That doesn't catch hardly any herring, river herring?
Well, in the Gulf of Maine, when under this scenario, when the 91 metric ton cap is reached, all herring vessels fishing in the Gulf of Maine would be limited to 2,000 pounds, just like when the herring quota is reached. So effectively, yes, if this cap is reached in the Gulf of Maine, then it would preclude all herring fishing from that point forward for the rest of the year.
Okay, looks like some committee members have a little difference of opinion. Start off, Vincent.
According to this slide, Terry, yes, that is what would happen. But you'll see in our committee motion that different gears and different areas will be affected. So to answer that question, yeah. Lori, can I just ask you a quick question? I just want to go back to the goals of the framework. And the goals of the framework, as it says right on your first slide, is to establish the process for setting. And I only bring this up because you have to look at some of the numbers here, okay? We only have 5 years of data points to set this cap number with. This is number one. Number two, we can't effectively monitor it, or we don't believe that we can effectively monitor it. And number three, we don't have any idea how it's going to benefit river herring and shad. But yet, we're going to discuss, as Terry just brought up, shutting down directed fisheries in areas. I think we have to think long and hard before we set hard numbers to this. I have absolutely no problem with establishing a process. Okay. But when you have such a little bit of data to shut down directed fisheries, you really have to consider it. Thank you.
Mary Beth and David Pierce, and then we're going to go with questions from the audience.
Well, I had a really general question about the draft document, but to go back to who's impacted by a closure or not, I think there has been some confusion on the part of committee members that's not consistent with what Lori just said, so I think we do need to clarify that, make sure everybody's on the same page. My thought had been, and it sounds like it may have been an error, was that we were being specific by gear type and accountability to that gear type that would not impact other gear types. And the way you just described that, Lori, it made it sound like if the midwater trawl cap in the Gulf of Maine were reached, that the first seine fishery and the bottom trawl fishery would be closed. Is that what you said? And is that the way we have it set up?
That was my understanding, and that's the way that it is in the document, but that's certainly something we can clarify. Let me look in the – I'm not sure what the exact text is in the document, but that was the understanding that we had been working under because we were considering options that included all gears or options for specific gears. The triggers are on page 17 of the document, and it does say that when the cap is reached – the directed fishery in the area would close and all vessels would be subject to the 2,000-pound possession limit. That certainly, if the council is going to move forward with gear-specific caps, I think that's something that we could certainly clarify in the final measures.
Well, I'm glad this came up because I think the committee was operating under quite a different assumption. And unfortunately, I mean, here the PDT has done a lot of work, but this committee meeting took place at the end of a very long week of meetings that started for me leaving home on Sunday and 2 days at Scallops, a day at the SSC, and a day at the Herring Committee. So it made it difficult to be, you know, to feel like you've done your homework to the extent you should. And so I think that's why maybe we have some miscommunication on some of this. But be that as it may, the question or reason I put my hand up before this came up was just a question on the analysis in the document. And I was looking for some reference to what the impacts would be if, I mean, we know that the majority of the fish that are landed are used for bait by the lobster fishery, primarily north of Cape Cod, and quite frankly, most of it in the state of Maine, by large percentage. But if we were to close a fishery, and that fish is no longer available to the lobster fishery, do we have any analysis of impacts to the ecosystem in the Gulf of Maine? I know that the state of Maine has looked at this issue. It's come up in the past, and they have some data that's available. But the concern truly is, I think, very significant. It should be in the document somewhere that, you know, replacement of the kind of tonnage that we're talking about into millions of traps in the Gulf of Maine can be very significant. And I think we just need to have some reference to that impact in the document, Lori. Thank you.
Sure, I can make note of that and add that into the impact discussion. I think we started to get into that a little bit in Amendment 5. I had pulled some information, I think, from New Hampshire that looked at changes in bait utilization and things like that. So I can definitely bring that forward and talk to the PDT about that. Back to the trigger issue, now that I've thought it through a little bit and the committee is recommending gear-specific caps, I think obviously that gear-specific caps would trigger a gear-specific closure. Right now, the way it's written in the document is that the trigger would close the entire fishery, but that doesn't make sense if you set up a bottom trawl and a midwater trawl cap in Area 2. You wouldn't close the whole fishery if you hit one cap and not the other. You would just close that gear type. So I think that was just – I think that's kind of come out of where we came from at the committee meeting. It needs to be redrafted for the document and probably reflected in the motion. But it would make sense that if we do gear-specific caps, that the closures would also be gear-specific.
David.
Yeah, I share Mary Beth's views. I won't elaborate because Lori just made note of the fact to deal with the language in the document and redraft that language to make sure we all understand that it is a gear-specific closure relative to a catch cap. There's no way in the world that we ever intend to shut down, for example, the purse seine fishery in the Gulf of Maine if the midwater trawl fishery caught its cap. That would be nonsense. So as we move the discussions forward and deal with the committee motions, all council members should appreciate the fact that the committee is looking at specific catch caps applying to the gear as described in the last slide of the presentation.
Going out to the audience, questions on Lori's presentation? Dave.
David Gable, Hampton, New Hampshire. Lori, I had a question on the, there was an early slide that said if you possessed less than 6,600 pounds of herring, you wouldn't be subject to this. As I remember, when I was on the council, it said A, B, and C boats, and it just so happens the D threshold is 6,600. So has something changed, or is it still like permit category?
Well, the idea is to use the landings threshold to identify the permit categories, essentially. I mean, by putting a 6,600-pound threshold in, that essentially means it's going to be trips by A, B, and C vessels. Because nobody, you can't land more than 6,600 pounds unless you have an A, B, or C permit. But rather than just applying the cap to every trip the vessel takes, we put in the landings threshold so that there would be an easy way to identify the trips that would count against the cap. So not every single Category C trip taken in every fishery that the Category C vessel participates in would apply to the cap. It would only be that vessel's trips that land more than 6,600 pounds.
Okay, I think. Because Category C boats fish for whiting, they fish for shrimp, they fish for a lot of things where they have a very marginal interaction with any kind of herring. Oftentimes they're using larger mesh than boats in the directed herring fishery, but they're caught up in this miasma of the herring fishery, if you will, because in order to possess a herring, you have to register for herring even if you're not fishing for them, which is something I still hope this council will correct in the future. But at any rate, as long as there's a 6,600-pound threshold, I'm all set. I was just concerned that the C boats, just because they had a C category permit, would be subject to monitoring every time they made a trip. Thank you.
Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Patrick Buckhead. With regard to the presentation, and when shore-based observer coverage was incorporated, and as it contributes to the weighted mean, was there any analysis or consideration of trying to match up known dumping events with that shore-based? So if we're going to, if the analysis is saying, you know, see where I'm getting at it? If you're not tying it with any kind of observer and getting a ratio, how do you know what was or wasn't dumped at sea?
Okay. Well, the first thing we had to do was determine whether or not the data that we were getting from the port side samplers was comparable to the data that we're getting from the observers. So we did that analysis first. That was in Amendment 5, and we took all of the trips that were sampled with river herring catch that were sampled by observers, and that includes, you know, whatever happened in terms of dumping or slippage or anything, anything that was recorded as river herring and shad catch by the observers, and we looked at all of the portside sampled river herring and river herring and shad catch estimates. We did a statistical comparison, and we determined that they are not statistically different. So that means that in terms of catch estimates of river herring and shad, you can compare the two. You can compare port side sampling, and you can compare what you're getting from the observers. And what that tells you is that the influence of slippage is not significant. It's not significant enough to make the estimates not comparable. We all recognize that slippage occurs, but it's the PDT and the data have indicated for a long time that it's a small component of the fishery. So it's small enough that it does not statistically influence the catch estimates that you're getting from port side sampling and sea sampling. For that reason, we were able to incorporate the port side sampling data in and use it for this purpose.
Gotcha. Okay, so and just so that I'm clear, so it doesn't affect, you can statistically pair them up, but it doesn't necessarily incorporate what was or wasn't dumped at sea. That just goes into the how precise the numbers are in general.
And the, yeah, it's in the observer data, yeah.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you.
Dick.
My name is Dick Allen, and I'm here representing the fishing vessels Gene McCausland and Isabel Taylor. And the question that I have kind of relates to the whole idea of kind of group punishment. And the reason that I bring that up is because I think the agency staff at the herring committee meeting said that one of the reasons that the slippage regulation was disapproved is because it was discriminatory, because it would apply to people who had not contributed to the problem, and that somebody could have been going along and not doing any slippage, but once you hit a certain trigger, they ran into a problem if they had a slippage event. And it seemed to me that same kind of thing applies with any kind of fleet-wide or group limit. So if you have a limit on river herring bycatch by midwater trawlers, it doesn't matter which midwater trawler causes you to get to the limit. And there were some comments made at the meeting that you really need to move this. I mean, David Pierce made the comment that it would be ridiculous to shut down the purse seiners if the midwater trawlers hit their bycatch cap. Well, you could carry that to the individual, that it's ridiculous to shut down an individual who hasn't had any bycatch because somebody else has. And so I wanted to make the point that Mary Beth made at the herring meeting, that we really need to start to move towards a system of individual accountability and full monitoring so that we can track individual performance, because it really is not fair, and group punishment is generally recognized as not being fair. So the idea that you're going to punish a whole group because some individuals might be causing a problem, we really need to get beyond that, I think. Thank you.
Are there any further questions? Erica.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Erica Fuller from Earth Justice. I want to go back just for one second to the Amendment 5 disapprovals discussion, because I'm not sure that that's coming back up again in terms of the process. I just would like to point out that the law does not require an amendment or a framework adjustment necessarily for a disapproval. What the law requires is that NIMS submit recommendations and that the council can fix them through the resubmittal process, but that this fixing Amendment 5 does not require a long process. There's revisions that the Herring Alliance submitted a letter on that could be a short fix. Obviously, the narrower, the better, and the quicker it would happen, but we would like you to take that back up again at some point before this committee discussion is over. Thank you very much.
Okay. I think what we're going to do, it's almost 12:45. I'm going to ask Matt to make the committee motion. And we're going to suspend discussion on it until after lunch. And Tom, after Matt makes his motion, if you would just present to the council what your thoughts are so we can also contemplate that over lunch, and then we can put a game plan together and see how we go this afternoon. So, Matt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Karen? The first and the only motion regarding Framework 3 that the committee approved was that in Section 2.2, Alternative 2 be the preferred alternative with the 95% trigger option, and to adopt in Section 2.2.1 a 75th percentile metric of river herring and shad catch cap for midwater trawl gear in the Gulf of Maine, for midwater trawl gear in the Cape Cod area, and for bottom trawl and midwater trawl gears in the southern New England mid-Atlantic cap area for years 2014-2015, no cap for the Georges Bank area in 2014 and 15, and to modify the VMS reporting requirements as outlined on page 15 and 16 of the draft Framework 3 document. The intent is that separate caps for the gear types identified in the motion. The Area 2 consequence closure area would be the river herring shad catch trigger area as depicted on Figure 2, May 23, 2013, herring PDT report. That motion carried 8-2-0.
Thank you. Understanding that discussion is going to be postponed till after lunch. Tom?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't really have a motion or proposal so much as a topic for discussion. And it's not a new one. We talked about it at the Executive Committee meeting, at the Groundfish Committee meeting, actually several. It was brought up at the Groundfish Advisory Panel. And that is what's gone on this summer with regards to bycatch of haddock and what its impacts are to the groundfish fishery and the future of that fishery. So I want to both talk about how we're going to fix Amendment 5, understanding that there are proposals that will take several years. And I think we need to talk about how we're going to approach those midterm fixes and how we're going to respond to what's gone on this year. And how we're going to move forward. So I think we basically need to deal with this issue on two parallel tracks, or at least have that discussion.
John?
We want to move as fast as possible on the unfinished business of Amendment 5 as well. And the in preview of coming attractions, the presentation we're going to make on industry funding of observers is the way we think we can do the observer work as fast as possible. I know us doing something fast is an oxymoron, but it is the way we think we can do it as fast as possible for herring, but also for others. And if the council thinks that's the way to do it, then it would mean that the other unfinished business on Amendment 5, the spillover, could be done as a single issue thing, and that might make that an easier, quicker way to do it.
Okay, last word, Tom.
Just a quick follow-up to that, and in terms of the process of identifying which things can be done quickly and through what process. Maybe it would be helpful for the agency and general counsel to consider whether a full framework or action is needed on all of those issues, if some could be handled in a more straightforward way that would accelerate the process.
Okay. It's 12:47. Please be back in 1 hour. We're going to start up as close to 1:45 as possible.